10. Mom, inner element. How do you get a bear to kiss you? Simple. Put an orange-flavored Lifesavers candy in your mouth and pucker up. No American black bear will be able to resist planting his snout smack upon your lips. Caution. Do not try this at home. My earth sign expertise is hard-earned, having spent 3 years in the company of Bruno, my furry co-star in the feature film Gentle Giant, and the TV series that followed it, Gentle Ben. Bruno, true to his species, had a sweet tooth. His handlers gave me a handful of cookies, grapes, and Tootsie Rolls to keep in my pocket so that he would follow me around and do my bidding. The orange Lifesavers were more of a Clint thing than a Bruno thing. I just happened to love them, so I used them for scenes when the bear and I needed to be affectionate. The movie Gentle Giant, which kicked off this phase of my life, came on the heels of my Star Trek job. I auditioned for the part, which led to me taking a screen test at Africa USA, a safari park north of Los Angeles that was run by an animal trainer named Ralph Helfer. That's where I first met Bruno. I was one of six kids invited to do the screen test in which our acting partner was the bear. Not an easy assignment. I was the last boy to audition. By that point late in the day, the bear was tired and hot from working under the lights. As I later learned from working with them, bears, when they are hot, sway back and forth in place, paws on the ground. That's how they cool themselves off. But I did not know that then. I was just a kid actor, persevering through the dialogue that I had rehearsed with my dad. There was no way for us to anticipate or replicate the experience of working with a 600-pound animal who stood over 7 feet tall on his hind legs and whose head was now swinging back and forth like a pendulum. The cameras were rolling, and I had a problem. Finally, I broke from the script, but I guess not from the character. I grabbed the bear's chain close to his neck and gave it a yank. "Ben," I said, "you knock it off and listen to me when I'm talking to you." At that, the bear held still, and I finished the audition. A few days later, Dad got a call from Ivan Torres Productions saying I had won the part of Mark Wedlow, a boy who befriends an orphan bear cub against the wishes of his father. Ivan Torres was a Hungarian immigrant who had started out in Hollywood producing sci-fi B-pictures, but had made his name and fortune with family-friendly movies and TV shows starring animals. He created Flipper, the TV and movie juggernaut that featured a trained dolphin, and Doctari, the TV series about a veterinarian who looked after lions and chimps in East Africa. Apparently, Torres had watched my screen test and was impressed by my handling of Bruno. This was big news for little me. Also big, the actor cast as Tom Wedlow, my character's father, was, and this seemed too good to be true, Dennis Weaver. The same Dennis Weaver who had introduced Dad to Mom at the University of Oklahoma 20 years earlier. He had since become an Emmy-winning actor, beloved for playing the funny sidekick Chester to James Arness's Matt Dillon in Gunsmoke. This was his moment of transition into leading man roles. In a few years, he would star in the TV series McCloud and the TV movie Duel, the directorial debut of Steven Spielberg. The actress, Vera Miles, a favorite of Alfred Hitchcock and John Ford, was cast as my mother, Ellen. And as with Bonanza, the producers gave Dad a little part as a villain so he could be doubly useful to the production. The filming was to take place in Florida. Thanks to the success of Flipper, Torres had built a 4-stage studio complex in Miami for his ever-expanding roster of animal-themed productions. For this reason, Gentle Giant, the movie, had a different setting than its source material, Walt Morey's novel, Gentle Ben. The action was relocated from Alaska to the Florida Everglades, and Ben was changed from a grizzly, which is native to the upper latitudes of the United States and Canada, to a black bear, which is just as well. Grizzlies are bigger and meaner. Dad and I flew first class to Miami from Los Angeles on National Airlines, a routine I would come to cherish over the next few years. In the more elegant days of travel, the flight attendants conducted trivia quizzes and raffles for which the prize was a bottle of champagne. I won it an inordinate number of times. Never drank the bubbly, but it was momentous to be sitting in first class with a bottle of champagne. Once we arrived in Florida, the trainers reintroduced me to the bear, Bruno. We had met fleetingly at the screen test, but now we had to get to know each other as peers. Bruno was in a large chain-link cage with a cement floor at the Ivantores complex. The first thing the trainers did was toss a steak to Bruno. He sniffed it and turned away from it. Lesson: I am meat, and the steak is meat, but the bear doesn't like steak. Ergo, the bear will not try to eat me. I am not a meal. Next, the trainers threw a box of donuts into the cage. Bruno tore the box apart as if in a diabetic frenzy, consuming its contents as fast as he could. Lesson: bears love things that are sweet. Sweets we use to incentivize the bear to do stuff. Bruno's trainers, Vern DeBorg and Monty Cox, then stepped into the cage and playfully wrestled with him. No injuries incurred. In fact, it looked like a lot of fun. I was too little to wrestle with big bears, but later on I did get to tangle with some of the cubs in the Tours menagerie. Everything was cool. I saw that Bruno wasn't going to hurt anybody, and Vern and Monty were really comfortable with the animals. They were always going to be on set, ready to assist me and bring Bruno under control should anything ever go awry. Furthermore, they had declawed Bruno and removed his incisors so that he posed no deadly threat. Measures that would be considered inhumane today, but were routine in show business back then. I am still asked if I was ever afraid of the bear. I just wasn't. The trainers and Ivantores saw to that. It was a different story when the big cats were around. A big cat is a natural adversary of a bear, and once we went to series, they occasionally brought in a cougar to play the heavy in an episode. On those days, it was like having the Secret Service around. There were men standing there with tranquilizer guns at the ready, and the guest animal was doped up a little to keep him off his predatory game. Suffice it to say, they never let me get too close to the kitties. Bruno was really gentle. When we were making the movie, I was still so small that I could climb onto his back and ride him. He didn't respond to affection the way a dog or cat does, with purrs or big-eyed tenderness. Bears have small eyes, which inhibit their expressiveness as actors, but he was always fine with me petting and hugging him. The only negative I could hang on my co-star was that he smelled. He also took prodigious dumps due to his equally prodigious diet. Every day he consumed a dozen loaves of bread, a few heads of lettuce, some carrots, a couple of bags of Purina monkey chow, and several boxes of day-old sweets. If I had that diet, my poop would smell bad too. The shooting itself took about 6 weeks. Dad had a great time hanging out with Dennis again, and everyone was pleased with the outcome. That's when CBS reached out to Tours about turning the film into a series that would pick up where the movie left off. Dennis's character, who started out as a pilot who spotted schools of fish for fishermen, would now be a game warden in the Everglades, looking out for poachers and such. Ben the Bear would move in with the Wedlows, setting up the premise that he was constantly thrust into the position of rescuing little Mark from peril. A series of my own. Sweet. Nothing against Ron, but I was competitive, and I can't pretend that I didn't want to give him a run for his money. Opie was already a household name. Why not Mark Wedlow? The TV show, though, would require Dad and me to be gone for 4 or 5 months of the year, every year for as long as the series ran. Not every actor wants to pull up stakes and live somewhere else for that amount of time. Vera Miles, for example, bowed out, citing her kids, who were going to school in California. Her role was recast, with an actress named Beth Brickell stepping in. Dad saw the opportunity as too good for me to pass up, and Dennis used his pull to ensure an expanded role for Rance Howard the actor, as Tom Wedlow's comic sidekick, a swampland local named Henry Boomhauer. Ivantores magnanimously agreed in writing that Mom and Ron would be given airline tickets, so whenever the Andy Griffith Show was on hiatus, they could come stay with us in Florida. It wasn't like Dad and I were going off to war. We were a tight-knit family, and this arrangement posed no obstacle. Or so I thought.
I don't know that I totally agree. This was precisely the scenario that motivated Mom to get out of acting in the early 1950s. She never wanted to be apart from her husband for a significant length of time. On top of that, Clint's getting Gentle Ben coincided with my entrance into puberty. When I was 13, my parents gave me the go-ahead to move into the third bedroom in the Cordova Street house, the one that Dad had been using as an office, probably because they didn't want to expose my impressionable little brother to the behaviors of his confused, newly horny older sibling. It was a good call. Let's just say that around that age, I became very active. Dad and Clint were away in Florida when I approached Mom, full of questions. I was used to Dad's forthrightness and imperviousness to so-called taboos, so I thought it was perfectly okay to inform Mom of my nocturnal emissions and my more conscious bedroom activities, and to ask her if this was all normal, and if so, if I was going about it the right way. The scene unfolded like one in a sitcom. Mom literally put her hands to her ears, horrified to be put in this position, speaking in a booming, la-la-la, I can't hear you voice, to drown out any further disgusting revelations that I might have been sharing. She said, you're going to have to wait until your dad gets home to talk about that. Ask him, not me. So, wait, I did. When Dad finally returned home for Christmas break, he gave me the usual no-frills, no-thrills, Rance Howard explanation. Some people call it jerking off, but masturbation is the actual term. It's all very normal. It's not dirty. Don't worry about it. For good measure, he bought me a subscription to Playboy for my birthday with a gentle warning never to leave an issue around where Clint could see it, or Mom, for that matter. Beyond my surging hormones, Mom had a lot of other stuff to deal with. With Clint and I both working a lot in the mid-1960s, her discretionary time dwindled down to almost zero. It became her duty to shuttle me to Desilu Cahuenga and the other Andy Griffith locations and to be my guardian on set. She was also a compulsive undertaker of ambitious projects. She organized the PTA pageants at our schools, flexing her show business chops to convince the other moms to perform intricately choreographed, elaborately costumed musical routines as the tap dancing mamas, complete with kick lines. An excellent seamstress, she became known in Burbank for the perfectly rendered doll outfits that she turned out for the school fair every year. Couture for Barbie, basically. She loved sewing those costumes, and they always sold out. On top of all this, she had to keep house. Our parents' partnership was truly a marriage of equals, a 50-50 deal in terms of love, mutual respect, and the division of labor. But in practice, it hewed closely to old-fashioned gender roles, with the Howard men going off to work and the sole woman holding down the home front. Mom wasn't a super-duper Donna Reed-style housewife. She was the first to admit that she hated cooking, even though we all loved her burgers, steaks, and Spam sandwiches. And she took no joy in the uphill battle to keep our house clean. Who could blame her? Both her sons were slobs, and she didn't want to press us, given our school and acting workloads. Dad pitched in with some dishwashing and vacuuming, but was otherwise monomaniacally focused on writing and acting.
Ron was the far bigger slob. He was allergic to performing even the smallest of chores, like picking his clothes up off the floor. In fact, when Ron graduated from high school, Mom hired a professional fumigator to de-skankify our houses upstairs, which was the damage that Ron and his cat Tiger had done. It wasn't until he moved in with his bride Cheryl that Ron was housebroken, and just barely.
I plead guilty. The bottom line is Mom needed reinforcements. The solution, for a few months anyway, was to have our dad's mom, Grandma Ethel, come stay with us and help out. She was an altogether different sort of person than our other grandmother, Louise. Whereas Grandma Louise had been raised in material comfort in a bustling town, Ethel grew up on a farm, riding horses and tending to the family's hogs and chickens. She had the lean, weathered face of a woman in a Walker Evans photograph, and she was reserved where Louise was talkative. The only thing that our two grandmas had in common was that they preferred to eat their meat the same way, fried and smothered in gravy. Grandma Ethel had a confidently steely air. While she was supportive of her son's journey westward, she still called our dad Harold and was markedly indifferent to Disneyland, Grauman's Chinese Theater, and anything to do with the show business, as the phrase came out in her flat Oklahoman voice. Still, she was truly impressed by the nearby desert and the mountains that surrounded us in Burbank, and by the ocean, which she got to see for the first time in her life in her 60s. Most importantly, she was always warm toward Clint and me in her quiet way. She got a kick out of our suburban baby boomer way of life, which was exotic to an Oklahoman born in 1904, and I got a rare guffaw out of her when I modeled one of my most prized possessions, a beetle wig. Mom had a tumultuous relationship with her own mother, but she really bonded with Grandma Ethel. Their favorite joint activity was to drive deep into the San Fernando Valley and beyond to check out the model homes in the new housing developments that were going up in the old orange groves. It's all built up now, Agoura Hills, Thousand Oaks, Westlake Village. But at the time, the area was wide open, and the air still carried the scent of oranges. In the mid-1960s, the Ventura Freeway, the segment of Route 101 that cut through our area, ended in Calabasas, 20 miles west of Burbank. For the remainder of the ride, it was just a dinky little two-lane road, which could make for a long ride if we got stuck behind a semi. Did I mention that we were dragged along on these excursions, too? When Clint and Dad were around, we all piled into the Supersport with Dad behind the wheel. Clint and I found these outings boring as hell, but Dad was gracious and tolerant. He understood that this was an escapist release for Mom, who dreamed of a bigger, airier place than our increasingly cramped house where we all shared a single bathroom. Given Mom and Dad's frugality, there was no chance that they would ever pull the trigger and buy a new-built home out in Westlake Village. They didn't believe in taking out mortgages, nor did they want to live farther away from the studios. But Mom and Grandma Ethel liked to walk around these showpiece houses that anchored these rising developments, imagining what it would be like to live someplace so modern, so roomy, so expensive. Ethel, a pragmatic woman who knew a lot about construction, had a good eye for structural strengths and weaknesses, which Mom admired. When Ethel noted a sign of shoddy work or substandard quality, poor drainage planning, cracks forming prematurely in the walls because the houses were settling on fill dirt, it offered Mom some consolation. Yes, it would be amazing to live out here, far from the intensifying, cough-inducing L.A. smog, if only these fancy builders had any idea of what they were doing. We were lucky to have the time with Grandma Ethel that we did. A few months after her stay with us, she passed away in Oklahoma, suffering a heart attack after making a long drive in a snowstorm to visit her sister, who was hospitalized at the time. Dad took the news stoically. We didn't travel east for the funeral because, as far as Dad was concerned, we couldn't. The Andy Griffith Show was in the middle of production.
Mom had her own serious health issues to contend with. She was in constant pain from rheumatoid arthritis and autoimmune disorder, which made her hands and feet swell up. Dad showed me a picture of the character actor John Carradine, whose hands were gnarled by the condition, to explain what Mom was going through. She wasn't as bad off as Carradine, but she really struggled. There were mornings when Ron and I found her still in bed with a heating pad, sadly looking up at us saying, "I've had another attack." Then she would somehow pull herself up to get her boys off to school or to the set, suffering with every step, waiting for the aspirin to kick in. That she could participate at all in her beloved PTA shows was an act of sheer willpower. The mornings after those tap-dancing mama routines were particularly brutal, with Mom blinking through the pain like a pro running back on a Monday morning. Jiminy Christmas, she was stoic. Mom did herself no favors with her personal habits, an inheritance from the health-be-damned Spiegels. She was a two-pack-a-day smoker for much of our childhoods, and she drank 4 or 5 cups of coffee in the morning, and then she'd drink more coffee still at her favorite hangout, Albin's Drugs, on the corner of Magnolia Boulevard and Hollywood Way, owned by the same family as our beloved Albin's Toy Store. The drugstore had a classic 40-style Formica-topped lunch counter and a staff of chatty, salt-of-the-earth waitresses of the same vintage. For Mom, a half an hour at the counter at Albin's was like a microdose of the escapist joy that she got looking at model homes in Westlake Village. One of us boys or the other often accompanied her there, kept occupied eating a hot dog or grilled cheese while she took drags on her cigarette and gabbed with the waitresses. She was happy and in her element with these ladies, and I could see how these moments with them sustained her. She had been a hell of a waitress herself in her younger years, she told us, bragging about the tips she earned. Albin, she said, reminded her of the greasy spoon coffee shop that her family had run in Duncan. Burbank was still a small town, and Mom, for all of the pain she endured and the responsibilities she shouldered, was one of its linchpins. She was always at the center of the waitress's chit-chat, prompting them to explode into laughter at punchlines I never quite understood. But her physical ailments caught up with her. Though she was only in her late 30s, she was aging fast. She dyed her hair for a while before deciding to hell with it and letting it go white. Like her parents, she was fitted with dentures before she turned 40. Her dental and respiratory issues were partly a product of the advice of a Duncan doctor who told her when she was a teenager that if she wanted to be an actress, she should take up smoking to keep her weight in check. Mom finally quit smoking when she was 42 in 1969, but by then the damage was done. She dealt with emphysema and shortness of breath for the rest of her life. Mom was also self-conscious of the weight that she put on as we boys grew. Dad was naturally disciplined in terms of physical fitness. He watched what he ate, seldom drank, and performed a set of calisthenics that he learned in his Air Force days. Leg lifts, knee bends, crouches, jumping jacks, and other old-fashioned exercises that, he pointed out, could be done anywhere and didn't require an expensive gym or trainer. Ron and I dubbed this workout routine Hickersize. We were busting his balls, but Dad proudly and defiantly embraced our term, taking the steam out of our suburban boy jive. Dad occasionally tried to gently cajole Mom into looking after herself by improving her diet and inviting her to join him for an after-dinner walk. It always disappointed me when Mom begged off. But Dad betrayed no frustration or hard feelings. He loved Mom without reservation or critique. I wish that Ron and I had been as kind. We were dumb, insensitive kids sometimes. In the same way that we joked to each other about Dad's receding hairline, we snickered about the loudly patterned muumuus that Mom took to wearing to conceal her body. We also teased her about her worrywart tendencies. As the sole woman in the house, she had to deal with a ton of male energy, which translated into roughhousing, nicks, bruises, and many close encounters with lamps and the corners of coffee tables. Mom lived in a constant state of worry that Ron and I were going to hurt ourselves tragically. This dated back to before I was born, when Ron was filming The Journey in Vienna, and they toured a castle. As they walked along the low ancient parapets, Mom was too concerned with Ron's safety to enjoy the outing, constantly reminding Dad to hold Ron's hand. Dad jokingly responded, "All right, Gene, I'll hold his hands and you hold his feet." This became a go-to callback in our family that I even picked up on. Every time Mom overdid it with the maternal fear, we would say, "I'll hold his hands, you hold his feet." We laughed. Mom didn't. She also had a tendency to pick at sores on her face, making them worse. This has now been classified as a disorder called dermatillomania. But back then, we wrote off such behaviors as the result of bad habits or character defects. To us, this was just a nervous tic, and another thing that Ron and I teased her about, along with needling her about her smoking. Dad was the arbiter of how far we could go in razzing Mom. If we overstepped, he shut us down, telling us firmly that Mom would quit smoking when she was ready to quit smoking.
When Cheryl, my girlfriend and future wife, entered the picture in my teen years, she witnessed us winding up our mom and scolded me. It upset her, for good reason, that we took pleasure in making fun of our own mother. I needed that lesson in maturity. I also didn't fully grasp what she was up against. Were she alive today, Mom might be diagnosed with obsessive-compulsive disorder. As proficient as she was at sewing doll clothes, managing our finances, and in general serving as the Howard family's chief operating officer, she worked herself up into a lather of worry as a deadline loomed, which again was an occasion for Clint and me to give her grief. There were times in my childhood that I was embarrassed about the visual disparity between Mom and Dad. He always looked the same, trim and handsome, while she started to look like a little old lady, with her white hair and pallor. One time when we were all out Christmas shopping at the Woodland Hills Fashion Center, an early shopping mall, a woman recognized me and approached us with an Instamatic camera. She asked for a photo, and my parents, who taught me to be friendly and accommodating toward fans, encouraged me to oblige. As the woman lined up the shot, she turned to Mom, gesturing toward Dad and Clint, and said, "Can I get your older son and his boy to be in the picture also?" She thought that Mom was my grandmother, Dad my brother, and Clint my nephew. Dad immediately put his arm around Mom and said good-naturedly, "I'm her husband, and you don't want me in the picture." Mom laughed off the woman's faux pas with an improvised joke about being a cradle robber. The woman flummoxed, dug herself in deeper with an extended apology before slinking off. That was that. But I was mortified for Mom, and, in the moment, mortified that my mom could pass for a grandma. I'm ashamed of these feelings now. I am also ashamed of how we teased Mom, and of the part of myself that thought she was to blame for her health woes and anxiety. Knowing what I know now, I'm in awe of her fortitude. She underplayed the extent to which that New York City street accident, suffered when she was only 17, shaped her adulthood. Yes, she made what the doctors called a full recovery, but realistically, she was never the same physically afterward. The accident affected how she carried her babies, gave birth, went about her day, and raised her children. OCD or no OCD, she had every reason to be fearful of her kids getting badly hurt, because she had gotten badly hurt. I should make it clear that Mom was not a complainer. A chronic worrier, yes, but never a moaner or a groaner. Quite the opposite. In fact, she was a glass-half-full person, an acolyte of Norman Vincent Peale's The Power of Positive Thinking. Her default mode was cheerful pragmatism, no matter the reality. Let's not forget that while Dad had the will and the gumption to dream of riding into Hollywood on his horse, it was Mom who had the actual horse sense. She was the one with a head start in show business and a practical knowledge of how to go about getting into it. It was her can-do spirit that propelled Rance and Jean Howard forward. In 1984, when I directed my third feature film, Cocoon, Mom made her first tentative noises about returning to acting, having forsaken it 3 decades earlier to focus on her family. I put her in the movie as a key extra, a background actor who has no dialogue but appears in a lot of scenes. True to form, she charmed everyone in the cast. She had some heart-to-heart conversations with Maureen Stapleton, Jessica Tandy, and Gwen Verdon, in which they, for all their success, voiced regrets about their life choices. They all expressed to Mom that they envied her for having spent the amount of time she had with her children. There is no one correct way to achieve work-life balance, of course, and the conditions for doing so as a working actress in the 20th century were brutal. But Mom was buoyed by her talks with Maureen, Jessica, and Gwen. They made me realize that for me, I did it right, she told me. Mom opened up to me further in 1988, on the eve of what would be the first of her three heart surgeries. We were talking in her hospital room, whose every surface, from her bed to her tray table, was covered in ledgers, notebooks, and boxes of receipts. She was feverishly working against the clock to get her and Dad's books together for tax season. There was an unspoken subtext to her urgency that frightened me. She was clearly concerned that she might not make it through the surgery. If she died, though, Dad could at least take solace in the fact that Mom had filed that year's returns and left him a roadmap for how to do the filing himself in the future. Typical Mom. She was more worried about Dad's having to do the taxes than her heart. That evening, though, Mom moved the conversation in a direction that was, for her, unusual. She spoke about her youth, which she was seldom inclined to do. With sobering candor, she described the ill health that had followed her around from the New York accident onward. The constant pain, the onset of arthritis, losing her teeth, getting hooked on cigarettes because of that ill-informed doctor in Duncan. This was all related matter-of-factly, without an ounce of self-pity. And then she said with a smile and complete sincerity, "But I had a wonderful childhood." I've turned this conversation over in my head for years. It made me recognize that for all of Mom's optimism and charisma, her adult life had held its share of disappointments. I didn't understand this when I was young because I was just a kid and she wore her setbacks and ailments lightly, at least for her kids' benefit. After our talk in her hospital room, I came to realize that it wasn't her family life with us that she leaned on to make her feel grateful and fortify her will to keep going. It was her memories of an idyllic time unviolated by struggle or physical pain. Her childhood. I had underestimated my mother. Not only how giving and selfless she was, but also how tough she was. I was allowed a rare glimpse of a more carefree version of Mom when, in the mid-1960s, CBS sent me to New York on a promotional junket for the Andy Griffith Show. Just me, not Andy or Don. Dad was otherwise occupied with Clint, so this became an opportunity, the only opportunity, as it turned out, for me to spend some leisure time with Mom in her favorite city. That's what she kept saying as we were flying there. New York is my favorite city in the world. The network put us up in the St. Regis, one of the Grand Dame hotels along Fifth Avenue. This animated Mom in a way I hadn't seen before. She told me why. In her and Dad's scuffling days, she often took walks past the St. Regis, looking longingly at its ornate facade and arched entryways. On these walks, she fantasized about what it would be like to stay at the hotel. Now her fantasy was coming true. We ordered room service breakfast, a first for me and a major departure from Mom's normal, frugality-minded ways. With CBS footing the bill, Mom cut loose. She took me to Sardi's, the show business hangout in the theater district, and delighted in pointing out all the caricatures of famous people on the walls and telling me about each figure. While we were there, I had an in-person celebrity sighting, for a baseball-mad little kid, anyway. Right before my eyes, sitting at a table, eating a steak, was Ford Frick, commissioner of Major League Baseball. With Mom's prompting, I introduced myself to Mr. Frick, and he kindly engaged me in some baseball talk. I have no idea if he recognized me as Opie.
Some years later, I too enjoyed a one-to-one work trip with Mom. Along with three other child actors, one of whom was Maureen McCormick, Marcia on the Brady Bunch, I was selected to participate in an NBC special produced by Art Linkletter, entitled A Kid's Eye View of Washington. It was basically an educational travelogue about the nation's capital, with the four of us as hosts. culminating in a scene where we all met the president in the Oval Office. Nixon left a lasting impression on me. He had wrinkles upon wrinkles and was sweating profusely. He also had a certain scent, one that I would later come to recognize as the acrid odor of a heavy smoker and drinker. I wasn't so much scared of him as concerned. To Mom, I raised the question, sotto voce, "Is he sick?" Mom assured me that he was just himself. And then we went to the Smithsonian.
The best part of my New York trip with Mom was the cheapest. She took me to the Horn and Hard Art Automat in Midtown, which was already a relic of bygone days, a reminder of the times when she and Dad, at their most penurious, could still get a cup of coffee and a slice of pie for a nickel. By the time of our visit, the going rate had risen to 15 cents. I placed some coins in a slot and pulled out a cheese sandwich that was totally underwhelming, cold and dry, with a limp leaf of lettuce and a colorless slice of tomato on top. But that wasn't the point. The aura of the place, with its still-packed tables and Art Deco design, sucked me in, and I understood the pleasure that Mom took in being there. While we were eating, we heard a voice say, "Gene? Gene Spiegel?" This was unusual. I was, by this point, used to hearing people call out, "Hey, Opie," in public places, but this was the first time that I ever heard someone call out Mom's name, her maiden name. We turned our heads. The words were coming from a diminutive man with dark, slicked-back hair and flashy rings on his fingers, a real Damon Runyon character complete with a fat cigar. "Felix," Mom cried, beside herself with excitement. The man was one of the little people with whom she and Dad had acted in the children's theater troupe a lifetime ago. She introduced him to me. "Ronnie, this is Felix. He was one of the groomsmen at our wedding, and he played Grumpy in our show." To Felix, she exclaimed, "I can't wait to tell Rance I saw you." Felix shook my hand firmly and looked palpably relieved to hear the name Rance. It hit me later that he might not have been optimistic about the long-term chances of the young couple whose wedding he witnessed. "Where are you two living these days?" he asked Mom. "California. Rance is getting work out there." "That's great," he said. "Yeah, I think about doing that too, but I keep putting off the move because I do the Christmas show at Radio City every year." "What brings you back?" "We're here on a publicity trip." As I nibbled on my cheese sandwich, Felix cocked his head sideways, studying me with a squint. Is this Opie?" he said. Mom nodded, beaming. "Well, that's terrific. You kids turned out just great." It was bizarre to hear someone describe my parents as kids. But as Felix and Mom gossiped and reminisced, I felt like I was traveling back in time. Here was Mom as she was before motherhood, playful, brassy, funny, and girlish, the feisty runaway bride. When we finished lunch and began putting on our coats, Felix positioned himself next to me so that we stood side by side. At 4'9", I was just a tad taller than him. "I could be a stand-in for you," he said, "forever hustling, as actors will." After Felix and Mom said their goodbyes, she was on a high. Her beloved New York City had delivered as it always did. It was at that moment, in fact, that she told me for the first time the bizarre storybook circumstances in which she and Dad had tied the knot. The hurried ceremony in the Kentucky hotel lobby, the repurposed Cinderella dress, the joyful reception with their theater troupe comrades.